Hello, my name's John Schaefer and welcome to The Wealth Show from CityWire. I'm here today with Peter Doherty, manager of the Samlan Hybrid Capital Bond Fund. Peter, thanks so much for joining me today.
Pleasure.
Good stuff. Well, today we're talking about contingent convertible bonds. Peter, maybe you could tell us what CoCos exactly are and maybe the common misconceptions about these bonds.
Yeah, well, thanks very much, John. There's a couple of things to bear in mind. One is that it's kind of across the global financial crisis, sort of 07 to 09, the regulators and the sort of the powers that be realized that many of the instruments that were issued by banks and insurance companies, but, you know, particularly banks, that were called capital, really couldn't be written down or couldn't absorb losses when needed. And so that was kind of a flaw in the system. So that ended up, obviously, then you kind of have this phrase where you had the privatization of profits and the socialization of losses. And so, you know, people put their heads together and kind of decided to come up with a new form of instrument called the CoCo for short, contingent convertible. And that's really part of a sort of wider stack of hybrid capital, if you like, and we'll talk about hybrids in a second. But that's what's called loss absorbing capital. So it's not common equity or ordinary shares as common equity, but it's something a little bit different. It's in bond format, it pays interest, and so, you know, really it's a sort of the riskiest form of debt.
Yep.
in a bank. That's the way to think about it.
So, you know, fundamentally, it's a way of banks to increase their capital buffers, and it's a type of debt that pays higher interest rates, but you're not paid out in the same way as if you were to hold a sort of standard bond in a bank.
That's right, yeah. So if you think about, it's not too technical, but you think about a capital structure. So at the top, or the very top, you've got obviously things like members of a company pension scheme. And if you're an employee of Barclays, you might be a member of the pension scheme. Then you've got depositors. Then you've got senior debt. And that's all kind of at the top there, the people who come first in the event of liquidation, if there's a problem with the company. At the bottom, obviously, you've got shareholders. And then in the middle, you've got this stack of stuff called hybrid capital, of which CoCo is the sort of most junior or riskiest. And I mean, the way to think about that is that it does apply to some recent events, of course, is you're taking the view that this company is going to remain solvent, remain in business. In the event of things going wrong, you've got a much higher chance of getting written down to zero, or it takes some losses. And in exchange for that, that risk of having a problem in liquidation or in takeover and under bad circumstances, you end up getting paid more along the way. So you get a much higher rate of interest along the way.
Now, obviously, in this situation, there was a problem. The Credit Suisse CoCos were written down. We're talking $17 billion here. Swiss regulator allowed this to happen. The crux of it is that the equity holders were paid something, at least maybe a lot less than the market cap before that weekend. But do you think that set a bit of a dangerous precedent in this market?
Yeah, look, I think there's a few differences and then some similarities between the sort of the wider CoCo market and the specific Swiss and then the very specific Credit Suisse situation. So a couple of things to bear in mind. Credit Suisse's outstanding was between 5 and 6% of the market, so it's quite a high percentage. So if you're an index fund or an ETF or something like that, you will have owned that. And of course, as a name and a country where rule of law and sort of banking professionalism is very high and very well thought of, the idea that Credit Suisse would be taken over in sort of a potential collapse and then have CoCos written down to zero, that is all a bit of a shock to people. But on the other hand, if you actually look at the documentation, this point of non-viability, this PONV clause, meant that at the point that the regulators deemed that Credit Suisse was no longer viable in its then form, then there was the option to write down the securities to zero. Now, yeah. I think behind your question, which is a good one, is really, is that sensible in a world where equity holders get paid something and retain some upside, albeit small?
If equity holders had been given zilch, then I don't think there would be a case. I don't think you'd have lawyers sort of chasing this. But because they have been given something, that there's surely a case here.
Well, yeah, yes and no. I think that's right. I think there's two things going on. Imagine a world where the Credit Suisse COCOs had been converted to equity and been treated the same as equity. I think this question wouldn't be around, and it probably would be a sort of, oh, well, that was very tough for everybody kind of discussion. And actually, the difference in value for UBS and for everybody else in that scenario, in relative terms, is small. That might have been a 20 or 25% recovery on those bonds as opposed to zero, but that would have made a big difference. So the other thing I would say on a kind of, sort of high level basis is there aren't that many of these events, and you only really find out what's in the real detail, when someone goes through it. And I would say that, kind of behind your question again, most people would say that it is reasonable for sort of COCO holders to get treated no worse than equity. I mean, that wasn't actually in the Credit Suisse docs. There was this option to do what's happened. I mean, and if people don't agree with that, they can go through the process with the authorities, and that there probably will be some legal challenges or at least a certain review of what happened. But I think on a forward-looking basis, it would make sense for the securities to kind of make you no worse off in liquidation than an equity holder. Can I just go into there's one more of them. There's so many variations on the securities, and it's partly one of the joys and challenges of the market. But there's another way to look at some of these instruments, and some have a write down and write up mechanism, and some are just written down. So what can happen is that an equity, a share, can still be trading, and the business can still be quoted, but this loss absorbing mechanism can kick in kind of in the meantime while the institution is still viable. So I think there's a view that yes, there is a capital structure, but some of the features of the instruments are unusual in that you can end up with a situation where you get written down and an equity holder, I mean, at the time you get written down, the equity will be depressed, but the equity holder can also then participate back in. So I think it will potentially lead to some documentation changes or some thought process about how these are structured. But again, I want to while I've got the mic, I just want to say I think the overall view, my overall view is that the takeover of Credit Suisse and that sort of operation over a weekend was an incredibly difficult situation that was well handled. And I think there are obviously people going to be unhappy and people will have to make some challenges possibly through the courts. But the idea that we'd be better off if somehow there'd been an extended dragged out process or hadn't been resolved over the weekend, I think that is flawed. And I think the regulators and the authorities did a very good job of taking decisive action to prevent what would be a massive global contagion.
Sure. That being said, it seems like these products are a bit marred by this event. I mean, you've got the Invesco 81 ETF that's still down 13% over a month. Now, obviously, a large portion of that will be the Credit Suisse bonds themselves. As you've alluded to, they're a pretty significant amount of the market. But are you a bit concerned that it hasn't bounced back yet?
Yeah, look, I think there's a few things. I would say personally that being an active manager with a smaller amount of money under management has allowed, me and others, not just me, but many people to avoid Credit Suisse as a holding, either altogether in my case and some others that I know, or it's been very much an underweight security. Mm. So, I think if you're a large investor and you need to buy securities to kind of use up your investment from your clients, that is potentially a problem. I mean, there is a there's a obviously a phrase in the banking market which is too big to fail. And I think in some of the fund managers who've got more capital than they can handle, I it's a bit of a joke, but I say they're almost too big to succeed.
Sure.
Because they're going to just end up owning the market, and your ability to differentiate yourself in that world is pretty tough. So that's one thing. There's kind of the size of the people you're investing with is important if you're just going to go for an index type approach. But the second thing is, it is a tough period for the market in the sense that you've been promised that banks are investable again, that it's a sector which has some good returns. And then this is a sort of, you know, bolt from the blue, and it's kind of a bit of a lightning strike, and suddenly the sector is down. Having said that, again, it presents opportunity. There are some incredibly well-run institutions with fantastic liquidity, very limited or no deposit beta risk. Of talking about this new world of deposit flight, and if you can pick up those securities, you're going to get paid now, you know, 10% to 12% per annum, and that's up from sort of 6 to 8, you know, a year ago, and that's a great number.
Sure. You mentioned that you'd avoided Credit Suisse, you know, sort of promoting your active approach. Why did you avoid them?
Well, it's a good question. I think there's my sort of central view is this, that we're in a systemic risk portfolio. What I mean by that is that the whole sector moves as one, that there is contagion risk. You know, banks are inherently risky. And anytime you see noise, what I call noise, or just, you know, lack of clarity, or just events going on that you're not quite sure about, there is not that much need to own that name unless you're getting paid an extraordinarily high return, which wasn't the case in Credit Suisse, Cocos, or other parts of the capital structure. I mean, the yields were certainly higher, but they weren't that much higher that you risked underperforming a lot if you didn't own it. And so we did have a couple of discussions earlier in the year about the opportunity. And as a group, we said, look, if we have a year or 2 years where you don't hear from Credit Suisse in terms of regulatory risks or business risks. And
They seem to
manage to attach themselves to most of the negative events over the past two or 3 years in terms of, you know, going to a bit Archegos and Greensill and other things. It was just literally, you could just sense that the lack of controls and lack of discernment of the business they were doing was going to cause them a problem. And it wasn't a forecast around being taken over and kind of insolvent, but the point was you didn't need to own that. But what's happened now, which is nice, is that the differentiation between names has gone up a lot. So what we call dispersion of yields or opportunity is now much more differentiated, which is a good thing, I think.
Are there any other banks that you feel the same way? For example, I don't know if Deutsche Bank issues a COCO, but are they in the sort of same league?
Yeah, they've got a number of issues, and we were very close to picking up some Deutsche paper post Credit Suisse, and Deutsche did come in for some sort of very singular market price action, put it that way. You know, the COCOs and other parts of the capital structure of Deutsche got very heavily sold off. We didn't buy that, and others have done that, and it's recovered very well, and they've done very well out of that. I think Deutsche had most of its problems, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. They've been through their tough times, and they are much more stable. But again, that's a name which I think, you know, don't forget our funds are long only, right? So we only have the ability to own the securities or not. And so we can't buy derivatives. We don't buy hedges. We can't short the equity or do other things. So again, I think if you have more tools available in a particular fund or strategy, nothing wrong with owning Deutsche Cocos either outright or you know, long one, short the other. That's all fine. I did want to say there are opportunities that have come up. I just want to mention a couple of names. People have got different views on things, but Investec is a name that we've been very happy with for a long time. Now, that's because they've been very, very liquid and with a lot of surplus capital, and they've just announced, as you might have seen this week, that they're selling the wealth business into Rathbones and taking an equity stake from that.
I mean, how much difference does that make in this asset class?
I mean, in terms of that specific transaction, you know, not that much. It probably de-risks the whole thing a little bit and adds some other risk in some ways and takes some risk in some ways. But I think it just kind of exemplifies the fact that they are a very liquid, sort of conservatively run business, and that's good for a cocoa holder. And then another sort of slightly smaller, niche strategy, but again, an interesting name is Irish Permanent. So they've got a euro issue. And again, if you look at the Irish economy, it's got a budget surplus. They're making very good revenues. The economy is much more balanced. The banks are, an oligopoly with sort of three or four large players, very stable economy. And that instrument is paying, close to 15% in sterling if you do the currency adjustment. And that's a very, very attractive return for what is a double B security. And
that's with the currency adjustment. Without the currency adjustment, what are you looking at?
Looking at about 13%, 13.5%. So you get about 150 bips or so pick up from euros into sterling.
Is there a bit of a liquidity issue with a smaller bank like that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one of the premiums getting paid. So again, I think if you're in a modest-sized fund with some flex, that's only really 3 or 4% position, but something you can hold, with a very high degree of certainty that you're not going to get an event risk like a Credit Suisse. It's a fairly boring company in a good way. Again, boring is positive in this world, and we like that sort of carry, and it's a great management team. So yeah, not something you'd own too much of, but if you've got a 5 or 10 million euro position, that's easily tradable and something that we think is very manageable.
Sure, good stuff. I want us to take a bit of a step back. I mean, why do you fundamentally invest into these products within your hybrid capital bond fund? I've noticed that the fund can allocate up to 30% of assets into cocos.
Yeah, look, I think when I set the fund up in 2016, it was on the back of retail demand. So a couple of points here. One is that in the UK, at least, unless you're a professional investor or you sign professional investor forms, you're not eligible to own cocos directly. So you need to do it via a fund format. So that was one piece. The second thing is, if you talk to many private clients, they like the sector. If you say, I'm going to have exposure to, Aviva, Legal & General, Lloyds, Barclays, etc., they're names that people like. And as we've discussed at other times, accessing the bond market in any part of the capital structure in the UK is a challenge on a direct basis. And so so having the ability to own the most junior notes of some of the safest businesses in the UK that people like, that is something that people like in a fund. I set the 30% limit because I thought, well, if you go to 50 or more, then cocos really dominate the fund. So I think and if you're at 10, it's kind of just not enough to really make that much of a difference. So I think 30 is a nice sort of number. We tend to sit around a quarter of the fund and 25% in cocos, which gives you a kicker. It means that you don't have to own the whole market, a la Credit Suisse. But if I can own, I mentioned, Investec, Irish Permanent are sort of different names. Then you've got the sort of mainstream names, Lloyds, Barclays, Legal & General, Aviva. These are great places to be, and it's a nice mix. And then on the other side of that discussion is the fact that we're not just a cocoa fund, and yes, I think that's a very important difference. So there are tier two and tier three securities. There are preference shares that we own, again, they've got some really interesting features. Most notably, that they are cumulative and actually must pay, unlike cocos. So preference shares are, there aren't many around anymore because they've been bought back, and they will actually, most of them fall out of the capital structure regulations at the end of 25. But if you look at pref from, Aviva, RSA, etc., to have those as cumulative must pay securities means that you are going to get paid. Again, that's a little bit more protection, ironically, than a cocoa. So Preston shares Coco's tier two. It's a nice blend, and that's why we've been able to, we're in a nicely positive return year to date.
Sure.
Despite being in a fund with a Coco exposure where the index is down 13.
No, so positive return year to date, but you still will have been hit a little bit by your Coco exposure because of the nature of the market in recent weeks. When we spoke recently, you said that you'd upped your exposure from 25% to 28% on the back of a buying opportunity. Why did you take that decision at that time?
Yeah, because I think it was a balanced sort of thought process, but the increase was because I felt the contagion that was kind of being discussed around the sort of global banking system was unlikely to actually materialize, and that's proven to be the case. And so you really had a situation where, Credit Suisse had fallen over, Deutsche was in the crosshairs, and that was selling off. You had this U.S. Bank deposit beta and sort of flight to quality into money market funds, and that's not over, by the way, but it all seems to be fairly manageable. And at the time, you had sort of distressed prices for names that were not really affected, and by that I mean the insurers. And so we picked up paper from the likes of Rothesay Pension Corporation, and these are just very different businesses. I mean, they have a completely different risk profile in their asset base and their structure and the way their liquidity works. And so the RT1 space, which is the restricted tier one, that's the insurance equivalent of AT1.
Sure.
That's a super place to be. And that was where we spent our money.
Excellent. Well, Peter, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, pleasure. Really good. And catch up again soon. Thank you.